Well, we're glad you're with us for our Bible study hour this morning. Great to be together. Good for me to get to be back after a number of days away. And I need to say thank you, but I need to say thank you to everybody. So I'm going to wait till a little bit later when the rest of the folks are in here. But we are so grateful for all the expressions of love and kindness over the last 2 weeks. My mom's passing, I'll say a little more about that later. But it's good to be home. Deuteronomy chapter 8 is where I'd like you to be turning as we get started today. We're going to be spending our time in a couple of chapters in Leviticus. I want to thank Doug and Jeff for teaching the class while I was away. We're going to build on some things that have come before in our lesson today, which is lesson number 18. We're studying this quarter in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. It's not a thorough examination of those books, more of a survey. And we're trying especially to make connections to the gospel. We're trying to look at these aspects of the law of Moses as foreshadowings of the gospel of Christ. We've got a great opportunity to think about that today even, some timeless principles that we're going to be looking at in today's lesson. Deuteronomy 8 is where I'd like you to start. Of course, Deuteronomy, chronologically, we're fast-forwarding a little bit from Leviticus. Deuteronomy is kind of rehearsing a number of features of the law, especially as the people are just about to enter the land of Canaan. There are a number of admonitions, and this is one of them. Deuteronomy chapter 8, starting in verse 6, "Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity, in which you will not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware, verse 11, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." That's just one of several admonitions that God gives the people. He will also give some in retrospect about how they ate vineyards that they didn't plant. They lived in houses that they didn't build and so forth, about how God had provided all of these things for them. But he's warning them in advance not to forget that. He's going to bless them beyond measure, but they can't ever forget where those blessings came from. Well, as we have noted along the way, some of the features of the law of Moses are designed for exactly that purpose, to keep the people from forgetting where their blessings came from. And really, we're going to be talking about some of those in our lesson today. Some of these things, again, we've already covered, so I want to review just a minute before we dive into Leviticus 25 through 27. I think it's on it's the very last page of this part of your workbook. You've got a little excursus on some Old Testament sevens. Of course, the number of seven always has symbolic importance in the scriptures, but in the Old Testament, the seventh chronologically usually carried some significance, and very often it had to do with reminding the people of where their blessings came from. For example, every seventh day, the seventh day of the week, what was it? Okay, it was a day of rest. Shabbat, Hebrew Shabbat, basically means rest, the Sabbath day. So what did the people do on that day? Okay, or the more important question is, what did they not do that day? They didn't work, okay? Was that just, oh, you can't work today, you can't go out and make a living today, you're making too much money, can't do that? What was the Sabbath day about? Okay, yeah. It was a way to cause the people to reflect on what God had provided. They didn't need to work on that day. They needed their rest, and God provided ample things for them so that they could take that day of rest. And it was for their good. It was a recognition, a couple of purposes that are stated for the Sabbath day. God resting after the 6 days of creation, also as a memorial of His bringing them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and by extension, His provision for them. Okay, but it was a reminder that they and their livelihoods and their ability to make a living all belonged to God. They were all gifts from Him. The seventh week certain time frames. You talked about, I think it was in our last lesson, talked about the feast week, Feast of Weeks, which was the seventh week after the beginning of the spring harvest, the day after the seventh Sabbath following the spring harvest. And it came to be called, anybody remember what that feast ends up being called in the New Testament? Yeah, it's Pentecost, okay? A celebration of the harvest, and a remembrance of the hardships of Egypt that God had delivered them out of. Well, we're going to talk, we're really kind of continuing that pattern a little bit today. And here's what I want you to keep in mind in all of the things we discussed today in Leviticus 25 through 27. We're not hitting everything in those chapters. But all of the things we discussed today are designed to remind the people that what they have ultimately does not belong to them. Who does it belong to? Okay, that's an easy question. That's a softball question, I know. But that's the principle that's at work. They don't belong to themselves. Their houses and lands don't belong to them. The produce of those lands ultimately doesn't belong to them. It is, to borrow a phrase, on loan from God. And these things remind them of that. So let's look at a few things, and these are laws that are especially going to are made with a view toward their dwelling in the promised land. And let's just talk about a couple of special years on the Israelite calendar that this chapter talks about. First part of chapter 25 talks about what was to happen every seventh year. And this just comes to be called a Sabbath year. By the way, when we talk about Sabbaths in the general sense, we may be talking about more than just the Sabbath day. There's a whole system of Sabbaths, a whole system of rests built into the law of Moses, including this one, the Sabbath year. Every seventh year, some special things happen, and it's recognized as such. So, this is question number one in your workbook, if you got a chance to work on that. What was supposed to happen every seventh year? Okay, all right, okay. Just the same way that the people and their servants and their livestock were to have a rest every seventh day. Deuteronomy, we didn't read this, but Deuteronomy 16 really emphasized that. You're supposed to rest on the seventh day. Your family's supposed to rest. Your servants, even your animals, even your livestock. You're not to put them out to work in the fields. They get a rest too. Well, by the same token, the concept of the Sabbath year is the land gets a Sabbath. The land gets a rest. And in that seventh year, they were not supposed to sow their fields or prune their vineyards. This is verse 4. Your harvest's aftergrowth, that is that the stuff that grew of itself without being cultivated, you're not supposed to reap that. The grapes of your untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year, or the land shall have a rest year. Okay? Now, would that require some faith to observe? Why? Okay. Yeah, it would require some preparation work. In the years prior to that, why would it require a degree of faith to do what God tells them to do in the Sabbath year? Okay, all right. We're not talking about hobby farming here. We're talking about their existence. Okay. This is where, you know, other than meat, this is where their food comes from. And to let their lands lie fallow for an entire year is a huge. So what are, in that year, what are they reliant on? No, who are they reliant on? Okay, they're reliant on God to have provided enough in the previous harvest for them to have plenty. Shane, go ahead. Right.
So that they were able to gather double the manna and it wouldn't spoil overnight. Because that one day, the seventh day, they weren't supposed to go out and gather the manna. They did, it turned putrid and all of that. That was a miraculous intervention on God's behalf for people. And so all of this continues, or should continue, to remind them of how God took care of them in the wilderness.
Yeah, exactly. Just notice, if you're in Leviticus 25, just notice how verse 3 and verse 4 should remind you of the way the Sabbath day law was typically expressed. 6 days you shall work, but in the seventh day you shall do no work. And here it's 6 years you shall sow your field and prune your vineyard and gather its crop, but during the seventh year the land shall have a rest. It's very much the same principle. Look at verses 6 and 7 at God's promise regarding this. All of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, your hired man, your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat. You're going to have enough, God says. You just got to trust me. And in an agrarian society, which is really what all ancient societies were, the Israelites no less than anybody else, is heavily reliant on farming. Not that we're not, we just maybe don't think about it as much. This is a tremendous thing that God's asking of them. Every seventh year, this is what you do. Now, let's couple that with another passage, and that's Deuteronomy chapter 15. So put your bookmark there in Leviticus 25. Deuteronomy chapter 15 says, at the end of every 7 years, which presumably would concur with the Sabbath year of the land, what else was to be done? Okay, grant a remission of debts, verse 1 says. Now, there's some debate among scholars, was this a complete remission or was this just a one-year reprieve? Either way, it's a pretty significant thing for a creditor to do. If somebody owes him money, to say, either you're not obligated to pay me for this year or the debts were given entirely, which I tend to think that it was a complete release of the debt. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor, verse 2. They could continue to collect from foreigners, verse 3 says, but not from their Hebrew brethren. And what's God's promise to them in verse 4? Okay. I think this is really significant. However, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess. Now, we're going to look at a passage a little bit later where Moses reminds the people, the poor are always going to be with you. That is not a contradiction. Just think through this. You have loaned out maybe a substantial portion of money. Remember, the Hebrews did not, they were forbidden to loan to one another at interest. All you got back was the principal. You have loaned out a significant portion of money. You are counting on getting that back, perhaps as part of your livelihood, but the year of remission rolls around, and God says you release that person from the debt. Can you see maybe being a little concerned, well, I might end up poor myself. I might end up having to borrow myself if I do that. I don't want to release those people from the money they owe me. Maybe that's a lot of money. But what's God's assurance in verse 4? You don't have to worry about that. You will be provided for. Nobody is going to impoverish themselves by keeping this commandment to release the debts. Verse 6, you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. That's kind of the general promise for the people of Israel if they keep these commands. And God goes on to warn them against withholding lending to those in need because the sabbatical year in which the debt must be forgiven was approaching. So that's what we read down in verse 7. If there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns, in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother, but open freely your hand to him and generously lend him sufficient for his need in whatever he lacks. That's the general principle. These people were to take care of one another. Verse 9, beware that there is no base thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the year of remission is near, and your eye is hostile toward your brother, and you give him nothing, that he may cry to the Lord against you, and it will be a sin to you. Okay? So let's say that I fall on hard times, and I need to borrow money, and I go to JB. JB, you know, I'm picking on JB today. And JB starts doing the math. Oh, wait a minute. Next year's the Sabbath year. If I loan this guy the money, I might not get it back. Tough luck, Jeff. Hit the road. Can you see the temptation to do that? Whereas if it was, you know, if the Sabbath year had just passed and I got 6 years, I got a good chance of recovering all this from it. God specifically warns them, don't do that. Don't let that harden your heart against your brother. You continue to be generous to one another. And if they will do that, then in that sense, there will not be people in need among them. You shall generously give him, to him, verse 10, your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all your undertakings. And then we have verse 11, which again is not contradicting what was said earlier, but he says, for the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy, and to the poor in your land. Does that remind you of anything Jesus said? Turn to Mark chapter 14. Now, granted, Jesus isn't necessarily making the same point here. Moses said, you're always going to have poor people with you. Be generous to them. And that is a condition, no matter what society you live in, no matter what government or economic system you live in, there will always be people who are struggling financially. God said to the Israelites, you watch out for those people. You care for your brothers and sisters who are in that situation. Well, here's Jesus in Mark chapter 14. We read him starting in verse 3 about when he is at Bethany at the home of Simon the leper. And this woman comes in, remember, and she breaks open this vial of costly perfume and starts pouring it over Jesus' head and anointing him with it. And the disciples get indignant, because this was expensive stuff. 300 denarii, we find out in the Gospel in verse 5. That's a lot of money. That's close to a year's wages for a typical day laborer. We could have sold this and gave the money to the poor. We could have done something really constructive with this, they said. And Jesus says, let her alone. She has done this for my burial. But verse 7, he says, you always have the poor with you. And whenever you wish, you can do good to them, but you do not always have me. This is a unique opportunity of which she is taking advantage. But even Jesus says to his disciples, you always have the poor with you. And implied in that's what's the expectation that they will do with regard to the poor? They'll care for them. That's what they're griping about right here in this passage, Jake.
Well, I know we see in the Old Testament that God's people didn't adhere to the Sabbaths, the land Sabbath, and they were sent away for 70 years to Babylon, so that the land would have its,
right,
its rest. When in the New Testament, when we see Jesus criticizing the Pharisees, I forget exactly how Jesus puts it, but they devour widows' houses. Is that
how? Mm-hmm.
Could this also be possibly them, you know, violating this 7-year forgiveness? Or
could be. At the very least, it's a withholding of generosity to the poor that was their general obligation. And the point of these instructions regarding the Sabbath year is don't let that affect your thinking about this. Just because the Sabbath year is about to come around, don't change the pattern of generosity to the poor. So yeah, it might have had something, he's not real specific about that, but all kinds of ways in which they could. But just, let me speak to Shane's point. Because one of the things the prophets in the Old Testament are constantly having to confront was people of means taking unfair advantage of people who were poor, or people who didn't have, a lot of clout, legally speaking or politically speaking, taking advantage of those folks. The prophets are filled with reprimands to the people of Israel and Judah about that very thing. And yeah, it just continues in Jesus' criticism of the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23. You devour widows' houses. You take advantage of the poor at the same time that you're, making long prayers for a pretense and doing all these other things to make a show of how righteous you are. And that's their hypocrisy he's calling out. So a couple basic things. No agricultural activity. You should just put that. And debts canceled. That's every 7th year. Now, when you're young, you think, well, that's a pretty wide gap. The older you get, every 7 years, well, that rolls around pretty often. That's just the perspective we have on time. Well, there is another principle that builds on this one, and that's what we deal with in as we go on in chapter 25, and that's question number 3. Here's what, anything else? Yeah, go ahead, Doug.
I want to go back to the cross not being sold.
Okay. Yeah.
And he explains it.
Okay. All right. Let's read it. Chapter 25, verse 20. But if you say, what are we going to eat in the 7th year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? Then I will go on, then I will so order my blessing for you in the 6th year that it will bring forth the crops for how many? 3 years. When you were sowing the 8th year, you can still eat old things from the crop, eating the old until the 6th year when the crop comes in. God specifically tells them, if this question comes up, don't worry. I've got it covered. And that's especially going to come up in what we're getting ready to talk about here. Just back up a few verses. Thank you, Doug, for highlighting that. Yeah, go ahead.
We're talking about the faith of these people.
Mm-hmm. It should, yeah, it should. I mean, think about that. Think about Joseph's experience in Egypt. Pharaoh had a dream that said there were going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And so Joseph's advice was, well, let's make sure we store up during those 7 years of plenty. Here's God's promise that in that 6th year, right before the Sabbath year, you're going to have triple production in your crop, so that you will have plenty to eat during the Sabbath year and on into the year that follows it while you're waiting for those crops to come in. And Doug's point was, that should have provided every 7 years a reinforcement. That sixth year, okay, God's going to take care of us. We should do what God says and trust in God's promise. There's more applications than we have time to discuss of that. If I just trust what God says for me to do, then God will hold up his end of the promises. Chapter 25, verse 8. We talked about the Sabbath year. Talked about all the things connected with that. Verse 8, you are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself. 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years. You shall then sound a ram's horn abroad on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall sound a ram's sound a horn through all your land and consecrate the 50th year. So now we're talking about a special occasion. Every 7th Sabbath year, that's 49 years, was followed by another special year, every 50th year. You need to know that there are some scholars who think that this year actually coincided with the 7th Sabbath. I think the much easier way to understand the text here, especially I think it's verse 10, is that this was the 50th year. So you had 7 Sabbath years, and that 7th one was followed by another year. And guess what? It was another Sabbath year with some extra things attached to it, which meant all the same things that would have applied in a Sabbath year seem to have applied in this year. What do we typically call it in our English translations? The year of Jubilee. Okay. When you think of the word Jubilee, what do you think of? Okay, you think of celebration. Technically, in English, a Jubilee is first and foremost the celebration of a particular anniversaries, usually the big ones, 25, 50, 75 years. You know, the Silver Jubilee, the Golden Jubilee, the Diamond Jubilee. But that aspect of celebration attaches to the word, so that really almost the more common definition is we just think of celebrating and being happy. And you may be disappointed to learn that the Hebrew word in Leviticus doesn't really mean that. It basically is the same word that was used to describe a ram or a ram's horn, which is what is sounded to signal the beginning of this year. So basically, if you translated it, it would be something like the year of the ram's horn. Well, that sounds a whole lot less exciting than the year of Jubilee. Jubilee really is a transliteration of the Hebrew word that is used here, jabal, meaning a ram or a ram's horn. So it's the year of the ram's horn. But the people understood what that meant, all the things connected to it. So in this 50th year, the year of Jubilee, some other special things take place. You shall consecrate the 50th year, literally the year of 50 years, and proclaim a release through all the land to its inhabitants. Verse 10. Anybody got a different word than release in verse 10? You shall proclaim liberty. Okay, that's usually the word that we're thinking of. Freedom, some translations have. Okay, that's the idea. A release, a freedom, a liberty. It shall be a jubilee for you, or it shall be a ram's horn for you. Ezekiel 46 and verse 17 refers to this year and calls it the year of liberty, which is probably another pretty common designation that the Hebrews adopted for it. As in the sabbatical year, they were not to sow crops or reap the aftergrowth or gather from untrimmed vines, verse 11. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? You have a Sabbath year followed by a year of Jubilee. How many years do you have of letting your fields lie fallow? 2 in a row. If it was difficult for people to embrace the concept of doing that for 1 year every 7th year, what about for 2 years in a row every 49th and 50th year? And yet God promises it will be taken care of. And once again, they had, as Doug pointed out, every seventh year in the year before the year of the Sabbath year, they would have that triple crop that should have been evidence that, okay, God will provide. We'll have everything we need. Each of you, well, just you tell me, what were some of the things that were supposed to happen in this year of Jubilee besides the usual sabbatical year things? What else takes place? Okay. Okay. Two really important things there that we need to talk about. Same as in the Sabbath year, plus property in open villages reverted to its original owners. Houses in Levite cities, their original owners. And I don't have this on the chart because I ran out of space, but Hebrew slaves were set free. Remission. Liberty. Freedom. So let's talk about each of those as we go along. Let's talk first about this. Chapter 25, verse 10. You shall thus consecrate a 50th year, proclaim a release throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. And each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his own family. Verse 13, on this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his own property. And there are some other things that are specified in connection with that. The principle here is simply what we talked about earlier. The land belongs to God. The people just get to use it for a while. And what the things in connection with the Sabbath year and particularly the year of Jubilee showed was, it was to reinforce that. So what Moses does, what God does through Moses here in Leviticus 25 is he talks about some of the particulars of that. Go down to verse 14. If you make a sale, moreover, to your friend or buy from your friend's hand, you shall not wrong one another. Corresponding to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your friend. He is to sell you according to the number of years of crops. In proportion to the extent of the years, you shall increase its price, and in proportion to the fewness of the years, you shall diminish its price, for it is the number of crops he is selling you. So you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. All abundantly clear, right? Here's what's going on. And just think of the principle we talked about in the Sabbath year with debts. It's pretty much the same principle. Okay? I go to JB, you know, needing a loan. And he says, nope, sorry, Sabbath year's next year, and I got to, you know, release the debts. I'm not loaning it to you. God said, don't do that. God said, don't let that enter your calculations. With regard to the land, it's you adjust the price of the land according to how far you are from the Jubilee. Because what you're really buying is not the land, it's the produce of the land. And so the price is to be, as we might say it, prorated according to how soon the Jubilee is, because what happens in the Jubilee? That land is going to revert back to the family that originally owned it. We're going to talk about why that happens, or some possible reasons why that happens in just a moment. Why would God have him make that adjustment? Go ahead, Charlie. Yeah.
In essence, it's a loan for the lease.
Yeah.
Return sale.
That's a good way to think of it. Yeah. Yeah. This is what we might call this a lease of the land. It's a temporary, you know, when you bought land, you weren't really buying it as a permanent possession. You were leasing it, and it would revert back. That's probably a good way to think about it. Yeah. He just doesn't use that terminology here, but we probably would in describing that. Just note, again, at beginning and end of this thing, God says, don't wrong one another concerning this. Don't cheat one another. Just as he said, don't cheat one another when it comes to loaning to the poor, don't cheat one another when it comes to these leases of land, essentially, the purchase of land from someone, you calculate those things based on how far it is or how close it is to the year of Jubilee when these things revert. Now let's go down to verse 29. And this may get a little, it may seem a little complicated. It's really not, but we just want to tie all this together. Basically, in verses 29 to 34, I'm just going to summarize this. If you sold a dwelling within a walled city, that was treated differently than a piece of property, a piece of farmland outside the walled cities. If you sold a dwelling inside a walled city, the seller had the right to buy it back, to redeem it for 1 year. And unless he exercised that right within that year, the dwelling passed permanently to the new purchaser and did not revert in the Jubilee. So a house within a walled city was treated differently. That was not a lease. That was a purchase unless the seller exercised his right of redemption within the, which means he had to buy it back. Houses in unwalled villages were subject to the same reversion in the Jubilee as open fields were. The exception is the Levites in their cities, and we haven't really talked about this, but the because we haven't really gotten to Deuteronomy or Numbers even. When the people enter the land, of course, the land is divided up among the tribes. What tribe didn't get territorial land? It's the tribe of Levi. What they got was 48 cities distributed throughout the land. And what God says is the walled houses within those Levite cities, the Levites had permanent right of redemption for those. It didn't expire after a year. 4, verse 32, the houses of the cities of the Levites are their possession among the sons of Israel. They don't have territory. They just have the walled cities and the fields that were immediately adjacent to those things. You may be beginning to see some of the reasons why this is being done. The fields adjacent to the Levite cities were not to be sold. They were a permanent possession of that tribe. So here's, again, here's the situation. I've got a house inside a walled city. I sell it to somebody. For the first year, I have the right to buy it back. After that, it is permanently theirs. If I do the same thing with a piece of farmland out in the rural area, they are essentially leasing it from me until the year of Jubilee, and then it reverts back to me, to my family. And that's every 50 years, that's what happened. We've got a couple of particulars that we've talked. Now, why would God do this? Why would God set it up this way?
Well, it essentially goes back to the family of their inheritance.
Okay. Okay, all right, all right. One reason was in Canaan, this is going to serve, think first on a tribal level, this is going to serve to preserve roughly anyway the territorial allotment that's given to each of the tribes. Because those lands always revert back to the same families, which are generally going to be in the same tribe from generation to generation. There's going to be some intermarriage there and all that. And on the family level, it's a way of maintaining that family's inheritance over the long term. Economic fortunes come and go. Family may not, they may not get to a point where they may not have a lot, but they have that piece of property that belongs to them, and even though for a while it belongs to, or is, as Charlie said, leased by somebody else in the year of Jubilee, it comes back to us. It is a permanent inheritance in our family. So there's a preservation of tribal territory and, dare I say, tribal identity and family property and family identity and heritage. And probably that would create some degree of financial security for those families. What else does this do? Let's go back to the principle we started with. This none of this actually belongs to you, God says. It belongs to me. I am letting you be blessed by using it and benefiting from it. If I buy a piece of land from Charlie knowing that in the year of Jubilee it goes back to Charlie, do I have a sense that this land belongs to me? Well, no, really it belongs to Charlie and his family. Does that help reinforce the greater principle that the land doesn't really belong to Charlie either? It belongs to God. And God is allowing His people to live on it. I want to fast forward to something, and we'll come back to the idea of, since we're out of time, we'll talk about the servant aspect of the year of Jubilee, because we really do want to talk about that before we leave this chapter. Shane made a reference to this a little bit earlier. I want to say it's in Chronicles. When the people of Judah are carried into captivity, this is hundreds and hundreds of years after the time frame of Leviticus. The people of Judah are carried into captivity, and Wednesday night we're going to talk about some things in Leviticus 26 and 27 that speak to exactly the set of circumstances God said would befall His people if they didn't keep the covenant, including these requirements given here, which included their being carried off in captivity to a foreign land. But the text, in describing that, says they remained in Babylon until the land enjoyed its Sabbaths. And that's essentially what God promises here regarding the land. If you don't give it its Sabbaths, I will. If you do not obey these principles, and again, it's not just a random, hey, every 7 years we've got to do this. If you don't do these things in recognition that I am giving you this land, that it's really mine, then at some point the land will have its Sabbaths because you won't be on it. I'll remove you from it and give it rest that way. Well, that's exactly what happens eventually and sadly. We'll talk about that a little more Wednesday night. We'll talk about what happens with the Hebrew servants in the year of Jubilee. And we'll also talk Wednesday night about, we've only got a couple weeks left in this quarter. And we're going to just really, I'll go ahead and give you a preview. We're not going to be able to talk about the entirety of the book of Numbers. We're going to talk about a few select sections of Numbers that are important for Israel's history. And we'll start doing that Wednesday night. So be ready for the rest of this lesson, and then I'll have some other material ready for you Wednesday for the next couple of weeks, and that'll finish us out this quarter. Thanks for all your help today.